Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is Freddie Johnston. He's playing a show in Montclair September 23rd. The details we'll get into during our chat, but it seemed like a good opportunity to talk to a guy I've been listening for years and years. Interesting to put together the singer-songwriter thing at the time he did, you know, the early 90s, but with a different approach, certainly not a folky approach at all, I don't think, but not a straight-up poppy approach either. He really had a unique, and still does, a unique point of view, and we'll get into that. We'll get into what the roller coaster ride of major label In and Out did to him, how it changes the way he did business and does business. I think it's super interesting and a unique window. Super honest here during this chat, so hope you enjoyed it. It's me and Freddie Johnston, and that's it. Enjoy. All right, there is Freddie Johnston. I believe he is on the telephone. Freddie, are you there?
How you doing, Michael? I'm here.
I'm doing great. I know that right now you are in, or maybe you're on your way, I don't know, to Fort Collins, Colorado. You're on tour with the Jayhawks tonight there, and you're kind of working your way east. You're going to be in Montclair, New Jersey on September 23rd at this big show. We'll talk about that in a minute, but your story is so interesting to me. You moved from Kinley, Kansas to New York in the 1980s. So first question is, was the New York City scene welcoming to you at that point?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what the scene, you know, being welcoming, if they always are, you know, everybody was very welcoming. It's a matter of, did I have the gumption, or what's the word? That's a Kansas word, I guess, to do the open mic nights, you know, and to learn how to tune my guitar on stage. And I didn't have contacts yet. Either I couldn't afford them or whatever. And so I can't see. So I was doing these gigs with no glasses on, like on Washington Street in Hoboken at a place called Live Tonight. The answer to that is, oh man, I got all kinds of, you know, open arms and help starting out. I was just a guy with a day job, and I had no idea that it was going to not, because other musicians, you know, had really started earlier. I guess that's the main difference. Is I didn't join a band when I was in my teens, you know, like a lot of guys, which is, anybody out there who's doing it, that's the way to do it. You know, start when you're 14.
Yeah.
Find a partner who you will eventually sue, I'm sure. But you'll like, together you'll make, you know, great music.
Just to be clear, you moved to New York to pursue music career.
Well, yeah, I did. I really did. But I was very, I don't know, man. I did it in my bedroom on my four track. I wouldn't admit it, kind of, you know, because I had never been on stage much, you know, but I was writing songs. And I secretly wanted to be a rock star while working my day job. There's a million guys and girls doing that today. And I got as lucky as a stray dog can get, you know, and I worked, you know, I played a lot of gigs, man. And then really what happened was my first record. Honestly, I think it's fair to say, I'm being really nice, but, you know, it's like, whoa, that guy's going to, you know, he'll develop, you know, he's going to get better. But somehow on the second record, I just learned how to write songs a whole lot better. Just it clicked, and it's a lot better record. And then I got a lot of help from my musician friends and my manager at the time to get this amazing group of musicians together. And the second record really showed that it's like, wow, I actually can't quit my day job. And that was very strange to me. And I will say this, that just again, just why beat around the bush? The common adage of success doesn't change you, success reveals you, couldn't be more true. So, you know, it's the whole thing of be careful what you wish for is just so true that it makes me laugh now, you know? Because I loved my day job. I mean that in a nostalgic way, of course, because I would be unhappy perhaps if I was still an office worker 30 years later and retiring from that office. But I loved my job. I loved going out to lunch with my coworkers and just, you know, it was just whatever.
When those first, you know, those first three records came out, I really think there was something about the sound, the style, the mix of influences, your point of view. There was something that was needed and kind of like filling a vacuum in the scene, something that was new. Do you agree with that? And can you sort of help me break down what those components were of what you were doing?
I don't know. Again, where like it's really... You got to be honest and humble. I don't want to listen to guys who are like, yeah, that was my period. And I was like, yeah, that's when that kind of genius came out. It's like, you got to realize that, like, you're lucky to be in baseball in the first place. And you don't even know when you're doing your best work. So it's like, you know, like the fact that 80% of our cognitive activity is subconscious. Well, that applies to songs too, you know? So it's like, I didn't realize I was suddenly writing good songs till people told me. They're like, wow, this is a lot better. What's going on? It's like, oh, I don't know. What I was really trying to do was get better, you know, just, and I was trying to emulate. I didn't really have I didn't have a whole lot of records just because I didn't ever have them. Didn't ever buy them, didn't carry them around, or wasn't a collector really. But I latched on to certain bands, like early on Steely Dan and because of their lyrics and Elvis Costello and Neil Young. And at that time of Can You Fly, I was way into the Pixies, Surfer Rosa album. Only that. I love the EP, but I would listen to that album. My neighbors must have hated me. I'm not joking. I would listen to Surfer Rosa 4 or 5 times. You know, A, side A, side B. Anyway, and the Mekons, Honky Tonkin'. Those two records, that's what I listened to. That's all I listened to. So I sort of like the non-rhyming schemes certainly come from John Lankford and, you know, Sally Timms. And I'll just say, you know, some really strange things happened because I was like, the Mekons to me were like, I saw them live once, but wow, I didn't. They're like deities or something, you know, and they walk by the club and it's like, wow. And then a few years later, not even a few years later, but a few years later, I'm at online at a gig and Sally Timms is there with my friend Tony Mamione from Piribu, bass player. I'm sure you know Tony Mamione.
Sure.
And Tony says, hey, Sally, this is Freddie. And she goes, oh my God, Freddie Johnston, you're a star, aren't you? And it's like, oh. It was that will ring in my head always as like the weirdest bell ringing, what the heck moment, because I was like, whoa, I was just getting ready to say, you're one of my favorites, you know, I didn't even get it out of my mouth. And it kind of, I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think it's good to be successful. That should be a t-shirt I should make. I don't think it's good to be successful, Freddie Johnston. I don't know. I think, or you've got to be somebody who really knows how to ride that wave, man.
Because why? I mean, you get signed to Elektra in 1994. Was the experience of being on a major label not what you were expecting?
No, I just didn't know the job at all. And I was thrown into this kind of semi-executive position where I had a band, you know, with a crew, and my manager at the time was like, hey, you know, you got to set the tone at the top and stuff. Like, I want to go back to my office, you know? And so I was a dick, you know, like, I mean, so many people are. It's like, that's not being unkind to myself. It's like, you know, I just really, you know, didn't really realize what I had going on.
And that's super interesting.
That's just really great it's great to have had it happen because I had great, you know, wonderful gigs, of course, as far as that goes. Like, see, I can say that, like in the chaos, but the fans from that era would be like, oh man, I saw you with the band, the Can You Fly era. That's one of the best shows I've ever seen, you know? So we had amazing, amazing shows. I will, you know, just to give you an idea, these are funny things that maybe people don't know, but I got really well known for 1 year. And it freaked me out. I went back to my hometown and a little house, you know, nobody comes to see us. We're just like, you know, whatever. No, poor me stuff, but like, you know, just a little, you know, my family. And people were coming to visit during Christmas vacation who I didn't even know. Like the local lawyer, his wife, my mom would be like, oh, here comes such and such. Wonder why he's here. And it was to see their successful son. That freaked me out. Totally. It was like, what? They would make the trip to our house. They normally would never do that unless they were going to serve a summons. And they would be like, that's not a joke. And I'm sorry. But, you know, anyway. My family always liked to drink. And anyway, I just think that some people lean into it really well. John Cougar Mellencamp took the ball and ran with it. I never was super, you know, he didn't blow me away at first. But the way that he did it, like did the whole thing that he did, writing better and better songs and becoming, you know, really just, I liked his stuff, you know, it was really great. So that I couldn't do. I just like, that's something that's in you, man. Hmm. And it's the kind of thing that I guess I'm glad. I think about this sometimes. Gosh, I got to stop talking about myself. But I'm, like I said, lucky to be in baseball, as my friend Mark Spencer used to say. I just get my daily chores done during the day, let alone run a successful career, you know? It's just, and that's just always been the way it is, man. I'm very proud of a lot of things I did. Like I said, I started writing really much better songs during Can You Fly? And it really blew me away. You know, it's like, wow, I actually wrote that. Like I remember writing Mortician's Daughter and finishing it and sitting there in my apartment in Hoboken and just like standing up and like, wow, I think that's pretty good. But you know, when you're young, like you do get these real insights. As I'm sure you've seen, this great video of Bruce being interviewed about writing, I think The River or Darkness at the Edge of Town. And he's like, he knows that everything he's doing is, you know. See, it's an example of a guy who he feels the weight of history on him, you know, and can really rise to it. Bruce is an example of a guy who's like, well, he just like is Bruce. I don't know what the heck it is, but it's Bruce. There's not, I mean, he's unassailable to me. It's like Neil Young. It's like, yeah, whatever, or Tom Petty, whatever those guys did, those are my deities, you know, and I'm sure they would say, like Tom would be like, oh, Freddie, man, don't deify me. I was just another screwed up guy, you know. And that would not be the case in my eyes. So, I don't know. Mm. I know I'm running on here, but it's all part of the story.
So, has songwriting like how long to how many, you know, is it days to finish a song or minutes? What is the usual thing?
No, it's not. I wish I could do that. I did live in Nashville and Austin for a period when I kind of went on a walkabout around the nation after I got divorced. I moved to various towns. And in those two towns, people did this kind of songwriting where it's like, hey, man, let's sit down and write a song. How about it? We'll call it, we'll have it about a bridge and a sky, you know what I mean? And then 2 hours later, you got a song. It's like, okay, you can do that. That's a way to do it, you know. And I never really came up with any way to apply that. I would say that when I did that with people, the songs were great. You know, I never performed them myself. But when I would work with people on songs that were mainly their first ideas, or we collaborate. Anyway, what I'm saying is I tried to apply that to my songs. It just doesn't work, you know. I can't tell myself, hey, Freddie, let's sit down here in a couple hours and knock this out. It's just like, it just doesn't somehow work that way. But yeah. I did have one successful co-write. But just the answer to the general answer to the question is it takes way too darn long. And now that since I wrote the last record and it's out, I was putting myself under pressure to finish the next 10 songs by the end of the year. And somehow I just realized, okay, I've got to just let the songs do that because I'm not quite 10 in. You know, I'm pretty hard on the lyrics, you know. And so I've just said, okay, the record's done when it's done. Like this, so if that's some insight into that, like, you know, it's I need a few more months. I think it really is. I think it's normal for me, even though it's as screwed up and uncommercially viable as can be. But it's just the way it's always been that songs are at least 2 years and generally 10. It's just from the first idea to the finished lyrics. Some 20. It's boring.
Wow.
You know, they're around so long. And it's just like, are you ever going to present yourself to me? What are you? You know, because the lyrics are, you know, the music and the emotion are always there from day one. And in my mind, I can sing it as like a hit song and I can get what I'm saying in a subverbal way, but I can't put it into words for maybe 5 or 10 years. And then the meaning of the song changes, parts are added, taken out. I'm very happy about it, but I look back and I'm like, wow, that was an odyssey. Like there's a new song on my next record that's like, it's like, man, I think I wrote that when I was first moving to New York in 84. And then it's had a part put on it for the last 20 years. And now it's needed lyrics for the last 20 years. And it's finally getting some. And I just got to say, that's the way I'm sorry for my, I guess, the way to put it. I'm sorry for my songs. They take so long. I'm sure they would like to be out into the world quicker.
That's kind of mind-blowing. Over the years, you know, I guess this is back to kind of the label thing, and the upside of that is like you get this access to this huge team, and you've worked with some interesting producers, right? Chris Butler and Butch Vig and Danny Kochmeyer and T-Bone Burnett. Tell me what...
All the best, man. Yeah.
What is that relationship like when you... I mean, I assume some of those guys are more collaborative than others. What's it like to bring in a song and to kind of seed some of the control to those guys?
Oh, it's always very different. I learned so much from each one of those guys. I'm still in touch with most of them. T-Bone's pretty, you know, he's pretty much on another plane. But I sent T-Bone an email a few years ago and got a reply, which was strange, you know. It was nice. And Cooch, you know, it's just, you know, and Stan Lynch had a lot of real wisdom to pass along. BV, of course, Butch's record is the reason people know me. And then, you know, the experience at Can You Fly, it was Graham Mabey and Newt Bone. You know, that was just, that I didn't really know what was going on then. So I can't really say how that process went because I'm just like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, I didn't even know what was going on. But working with Butch was the first time it was very clear. It's like, this is how we do a professional record, you know, or not that Can You Fly wasn't. Can You Fly was like, hey, the label can afford to get some hours from 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. at the studio, you know, or the label would give us enough money for that, you know, not criticizing the label, but we had to go on a budget. But I will say, and it's just true, when I tiresomely quote other producers, like an old man sitting on the front porch of the country store, it's generally T-Bone Burnett, because he said a few things to me that's still profound and I think are still useful. The one thing that Danny Kochmeyer said, and I don't know if he made it up, but it's true. He said, I'll tell you how to make a great record, Freedy. You give me 10 great songs. It's just so great. So Brooklyn. It's like, you know, that sounds like a good plan, boss.
Yeah.
He said, you give me 10 great songs, I'll make a great record. And it's like, it seems so clear. It's like, I'll make it sound good once you give me the idea. But anyway, the heaviest production that was ever laid on me was from T-Bone Burnett. I was spending the label's money at the Village Recorder, Jim Keltner, good Lord, can almost smell the money burning in the tubes. But it was a great, great time because it was very extravagant. And T-Bone Burnett was just like treating it like, oh, great. You know, he's like, bring a couch in. I want a couch in the studio room where the band is recording, you know, so I can sit in there. You know, so it was really great. And I was working on a song called Moving on a Holiday, and I couldn't get the lyrics done. We were doing it live, you know, like, he turned from the board and said to me, I'll never forget, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, Freedy, can't you just, in a spirit of generosity and humility, sing what's in your heart? And I just remember being almost like hit by some kind of ninja mind wave, you know? It was like, whoa, it almost knocked me back physically because it's like, that's some heavy production for Bob Dylan, you know, or somebody who's like, or Chrissy Hynde. But I think I said, it's like, I can't do it, boss. You know, something like that. I just like, no, I need an hour. And I went and finished the lyrics. But he meant it to be like, here's my best fastball. How you gonna deal with it, kid? It's like, wow. Well, it'll work on some people, because I'm sure Bono would have said, you're right. I got this, you know? And it would have been amazing. And I mean that. Bono's, you know, he's like big star. So I went back upstairs to the top floor. If people will know this reference, if they've been there, the top floor of the Village Recorder, still there with the old ATR half-inch mixdown machines, where with those little carpeted rooms with carpet like on the walls, where all the songwriting and the hijinks happened, you know, during the Fleetwood Mac era and stuff. It was funny as heck. And there I am in one of these little barren rooms finishing one of my songs. Anyway, that's the heaviest production story I got.
Folks can get information about all of your records if they go to freddiejohnston.com. Let's talk about this show that's coming up. It is the Outpost Fest, which is an outdoor thing at the Van Vleck House in Montclair, New Jersey. Lots of interesting folks on the bill: Nicole Atkins, Joe Pug, Hodero, Deborah Devi, and Adam Falcon. It's 2 weeks from now, Saturday, September 23rd. Six acts, two stages, and folks can get information at outpostintheburbs.com. I guess they can get tickets as well. Is there? So what is touring like these days? Do you still love connecting with an audience?
Oh, yeah. Touring is something that is, for me now, it's like every couple months I'll do like this. I'm doing, you know, these Jayhawks shows and the Montclair show, and then take a month off, fly back home. So that's kind of what it's been, which is great, because I love where I live in Portland, Oregon. I love Portland, Maine, too.
What is left to do for you? Do you just want to keep putting out records every couple of years and touring? Is that your plan?
No, I'm unabashedly saying it now. I have a whole bunch of paintings that I'm trying to finish, and here in Portland. And they are these big figurative paintings that a series of, anyway, it's a job that I'm going to finish. I did it like most musicians. I was in art school for one semester, and then a few years ago I started doing it again, and now I've got these things staring at me that I've got to finish. And so that's kind of, it helps the songwriting in a way, because I get involved doing that, and I don't even, and then an idea will come out, you know. It's sort of like, if the song isn't being paid attention to, it's like, hey, wait, no. it's like, wait, I got an idea after all. It's like, oh, really? Okay.
So put down that paintbrush and pay attention to me.
Yeah, hey, what about me? So I'm really glad for that. I did it for a while, not telling anybody. Very nervous about it, because I don't like it seeing, I don't know, if you're going to cross over into some, you know, other art form, you better do it well, or at least you better not do it well, but you know what I'm saying? Either do it okay, or don't talk about it. So I'm going to do this. I'm going to have a show sometime next year here in Portland.
The show, well, if you're in Fort Collins, Colorado, tonight with the Jayhawks, and check freddiejohnston.com for all his touring plans. And there's information about his records, and I assume there'll be stuff about your paintings and stuff in the future. But the big news is
coming up.
Yeah, the big news, September 23rd, Montclair at the Outpost in the Burbs at the Van Vleck House, the Outpost Fest, and information, tickets about that at outpostintheburbs.org. That sounds like a fun day. I guess we'll see you there, Freddie, and thanks for such a interesting look into how you have done for so many years what you are doing.
Oh, goodness. I hope that what I've said is, I don't know, I hope it came off well. I will say that I'm going to be playing with my buddy James Mastro. We'll be an acoustic rock duo at the Montclair Outpost Fest. So see you there.
Yeah, terrific. See you there. Thank you, Freddie.
Okay. Bye, Michael.
I know I got a bad reputation, and it isn't just talk, talk, talk. If I could only give you everything, you know I haven't got. I couldn't have one conversation talk. Nobody's gonna tell me who to love. Been breaking down. Do you want me now? Do you want me now?